Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's Essential Morning Show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Today, Boeing juggling new fears on the safety of the 737 MAX jet.
It's $1 billion a month for every month that they don't get that plane back up and running.
We'll hear from Ralph Nader.
The Boeing marketeers overruled the Boeing engineers.
The consumer advocate who got seatbelts required in cars is taking on leadership at Boeing. And an 11th-hour settlement from drug companies before the first federal case on the opioid crisis was set to go to trial.
This opioid epidemic is an urgent public health crisis, and you want to get the money to the people who need it now.
Plus, an update on the U.S.-China trade war.
Why can't we all just get along?
Why can't we all just get along?
And Facebook's push into cryptocurrency. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Monday, October 21st, 2019. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Shares of Boeing under pressure again this morning. That stock, as you know, fell at nearly 7% on Friday. That's its worst drop since February of 2016, after it was revealed that officials in Washington are intensifying their probe into the company's troubled 737 MAX jet. Boeing said yesterday it's still investigating leaked messages from a former test pilot from 2016 about erratic software behavior on the 737 MAX jet. And later in the show, we're going to talk to Ralph Nader about the 737 MAX investigation. But I will say one of the nuances, and look, you don't know who to believe in this, but if you really read through what Boeing is trying to say about the messages that we saw on Friday and what this test pilot was saying, if they're to be believed, is they're saying that these messages, they're saying that they lied about this and that the plane was working erratically, were really about a simulator, right, that they were claiming was malfunctioning, not the plane itself. Now, I'm not sure what the actual answer is.
They turned these messages over to the criminal investigation months ago.
Right.
The FAA wants to know why they were so slow in bringing these to the FAA's attention.
Well, the piece today in the Journal is that a lot of the engineers at Boeing are like contracted out to help the FAA, so they have this dual role.
Well, and dual role is a big problem. Pressure.
Now, you see the stock today. That's today.
Right.
That's 649. So my point, just separate from Boeing, is that the Dow's up 65, and
even
it's got
this pressure that's coming
50 points.
Right.
So we're really, it would be triple digits if it wasn't in gains. I don't know why. There's
I got to look through the other components.
News out of China.
Right.
Well, we have to decide what the other components are.
that squirmy, constantly changing Dow component list.
Apparently, Goldman Sachs is.
Yes, and Nike.
Walgreens
Boots.
So, you know.
I'm going to look this morning and see how these other ones are doing.
What the Dow actually consists of, and then we can look at which ones are down. New this morning, though, I don't know whether there's positive news or negative news coming out of China. So something about tariffs, but out of China, let's get to Eunice Yun in Beijing for the latest. I saw something quickly, Eunice, retaliatory tariffs, but a pretty small number on the big frame of things, but still it looked like. It didn't look like, gosh, we're all in this great new deal and we love each other. That's not what it looked like this morning. What's the latest?
Well, you know, actually, the vice premier did send some positive signals over the weekend. He made a rare public speech about the trade talks, and it seemed like he was trying to say that there has been some progress made. So at a tech event that was totally unrelated, he said, China and the U.S. have made substantial progress in many aspects and laid an important foundation for a phase one agreement. China is willing to work in concert with the U.S. to address each other's core concerns. Now, I know that those comments sound like the standard boilerplate lines that you hear of the government, because that's actually what I thought when I first woke up and saw them. But what was interesting was how the state media has been portraying them. So the Global Times, which is a Communist Party paper, has described his remarks as the most clear and authoritative on progress by Beijing. And then separate to that, state media blog Taiwan, which is closely watched by trade experts because they believe that it's somebody on the Chinese negotiating team who's blogging anonymously, that blogger said that Liu's comments indicate that the negotiators are, quote, approaching a phase one agreement. So the official press by and large, has been trying to manage the expectations of the trade talks. But now it looks as though they're turning a little bit more optimistic about the outcome for the phase one agreement. So that optimism helped to inject some positivity in the stock markets today, which largely shrugged off, which something that turned out to be a big surprise in the stock markets. And that is that the central bank had decided to leave the new benchmark lending rate, the LPR, unchanged in October. Most people were expecting the policymakers to want to continue to loosen because of the conditions of the economy. However, it's unchanged. So some analysts were saying this might mean that the policymakers are feeling a little bit nervous about loosening policy too quickly and by too much. But for the most part, there seems to be agreement that there's only so much that the policymakers can do to stop this trend of easing policy. And in fact, a Reuters poll said that they expect the one-year LPR to drop to 4% by the end of this year. So that's a 20 basis point lower.
All right. Eunice, just, you know, stay where you are. Keep your ears open. Today, Facebook's taking new steps to combat growing concerns about, it says here, about its digital currency Libra, which is, I guess, it's not really Facebook's digital currency Libra. It's a plan at some point to have something called Libra, but they don't have one yet. According to Reuters, the executive leading the company's crypto initiative told a banking seminar that it could use cryptocurrencies based on national currency, such as the dollar, instead of the synthetic one it initially proposed. I don't know what they mean by that. Maybe specifically on the dollar instead of a basket of currencies, because that's what was proposed anyway. We had David Marcus on, and we told him you should base it on Bitcoin. I guess that would be too humiliating.
By the way, though, they're trying to say it's no longer a Facebook project, that it's out there and it's separate from them.
Right.
But I don't know how they're going to shake. I don't know how they're going to shake that they created the idea. They started this whole thing. They're trying to separate themselves from Facebook because of the scrutiny that Facebook is receiving from regulators because of privacy and other election concerns.
I would think that the government actually would be okay with this one. That's the one thing I've been shocked about, because it's actually fully controllable.
It doesn't disrupt the dollar.
And it's controllable, meaning there's a central group. You could control the group, unlike other currencies.
That sounds great.
Well, you may dislike it.
No, it's great for the right.
But I'm saying, as a government, I find it the whole thing. So
why should I be happy? It's great for the government and not for the consumer. I'm a consumer.
No, but my point is, I could understand if the government was going after Bitcoin. That I could understand, because it's effectively an uncontrollable situation. This is like, I know who to call. I can pick up the phone.
That's what I've said for a long time. This is more like a debit card than a digital currency. But there may be some confusion about what it is. And again, just the association with Facebook.
J.P. Morgan does one. They're all trying to do this.
Right.
They're all trying to do this.
Well, we're referencing J.P. Morgan. Facebook is the project has suffered some setbacks, including the exodus of some early backers. Just MasterCard, Visa, eBay, PayPal. And Booking's holdings.
Because regulators told them. There were a couple of senators who said, if you don't disassociate, we're going to come after you.
That looked pretty good,
too.
Though. When you had those guys in the consortium, it looked pretty good.
Right.
And they leave, it's like, whoa.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, a major settlement moments before the country's first federal trial on the opioid crisis. Journalist Bethany McLean.
What about retribution? Don't the people who played such a big role in this have to pay? Do they just get to wave their hands and pay their shareholders money and make this go away?
This is Squawk Pod. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Good morning. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, along with Becky Quick and Joe Kernan this morning.
Several pharmaceutical companies reached a last-minute settlement totaling $260 million this morning in the nation's first federal legal battle over the opioid epidemic. Opening statements were set to begin today in a landmark jury trial brought by two Ohio counties against several drug makers accused of fueling the public health crisis, which has claimed more than 400,000 lives in the U.S. in the past two decades. The closely watched Almost trial was considered the legal bellwether of how broader litigation might be resolved as thousands of cases remain pending across the country. Our reporter Meg Terrell brought us the story as it was breaking from outside the U.S. District Courthouse in Cleveland, Ohio.
Literally the minutes leading up to opening arguments here in Cleveland, reports that four of the defendants involved in the trial here have reached a settlement with just these two Ohio counties to avoid going to trial here. Those defendants are McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, and Teva Pharmaceuticals, the three big distributors and the one drug maker left in the trial here. Now, this is not a broader settlement, according to the Wall Street Journal reporting that we're seeing here, that would take care of the thousands of cases against these companies. It is just to avoid going to trial here today. There is a fifth defendant, Walgreens, that the Wall Street Journal reports hasn't yet reached a settlement. It's unclear whether the trial would continue with just that one defendant. Now, we are trying to dig more into this. The Journal's reporting that the settlement details should be out before opening arguments at 9 a.m., so we'll keep an eye on this space. But again, this would just take care of the trial set to begin here today, not the thousands of cases still pending in the opioid crisis. Back over to you guys.
Okay. Meg, thank you for that. If this was the bellwether, to take it out of the mix, gets interesting in terms of what happens next.
Joining us right now to talk more about this is Bethany McLean. She is Vanity Fair's contributing editor. What do you think about the calculus trying to figure out whether to settle in some of these situations or go ahead and go to trial?
Well, it's a really interesting calculus. I think the companies, J&J in particular, feel strongly that the laws on which a lot of this is being based, the so-called public nuisance laws, are not being used appropriately, and that if they could fight this all the way to the Supreme Court, they could win. But the issue, of course, is that that will take a lot of time. It will be an enormous drain on resources, and shareholders for sure don't want to see that happen. So they have a decision to make.
That decision, though, when you are talking about settling on a county by county or municipality by municipality situation, what would that add up to over time, too?
Well, it would be enormous. If they can't strike this global settlement, there's resolving these cases on a one-off basis. There are well over 2,000 of them. There's just no way to fight through that unless you can get some kind of global settlement. And so that's where we are. And I think the states and everybody who's suing the plaintiffs in this case, there are just so many issues. One is the payment to the plaintiff's lawyers. Another is that the states don't want to see happen what happened in tobacco litigation, where there was this massive settlement, but the money ended up being used to plug budget holes, and very little of it actually went to the people who needed it. And then there's this feeling we all have, right, which may be emotional rather than practical, but what about retribution? Don't the people who played such a big role in this have to pay more than, do they just get to wave their hands and pay their shareholders money and make this go away?
What do you think of the states and the counties that have gone first? You look at Oklahoma, you look at these two counties in Ohio. Are they right to go first? Because there is going to be a big pot of money. The question is how that gets divvied up, how much the lawyers take, how much gets splintered and sent in different directions.
Right. Well, there's such a long appeals process for all of this. So in Oklahoma, Johnson & Johnson is appealing the $570 million verdict, which turned out to be overstated by $100 million or so because the judge made an arithmetic error, but whatever. So J&J is appealing that, and that process will take a long time. When I talked to David Sackler, he said to me, and this is both a self-serving comment and a true comment, he said to me, look, let's find a solution. Let's figure out how to pay now and how to work toward a solution instead of all of us chewing up our time and resources in court. And so there's some truth to that, right? This opioid epidemic is an urgent public health crisis, and you want to get the money to the people who need it now. On the other hand, to see companies sort of short-circuit the process in a way and be able to just pay and walk away feels wrong, too. So I think it's a really fraught moment.
Obviously, Sackler with Purdue Pharmaceuticals, that company is going into bankruptcy. What do you think the fate of other companies will be, whether that be Mallinckrodt, whether that be Johnson & Johnson, any of these big names involved?
Well, if they can't strike a settlement on this, I think Teva is the one that's most at risk because they're the smallest company with the least cash flow. The distributors who are being sued are some of the biggest companies, at least by revenue in the U.S., although their profit margins are thin. So they've got some exposure, too. J&J is just facing litigation on so many fronts, and thus far their approach has been, we're fighting this. At some point, I think that becomes unsustainable, both in litigation costs, J&J's got the money to pay for it, but just in terms of management time being spent, I don't think shareholders will stand for it.
Bethany, thank you for your time. It's good to see you.
Thanks, you too.
Next on Squawk Pod, corporate turbulence at Boeing continues. We'll talk to a public relations expert.
You have the real solution, and then you have the theater of crisis management.
But will the company's C-suite come through for consumers? Ralph Nader weighs in.
So people at the top are all in the same pit together. They don't want to admit that they performed in a very seriously adverse way to the safety of airline passengers.
Back after this.
Stand by, Joe, in 5 seconds.
Four, you're listening to Squawk three, Pod. Here's Joe Kernan.
One is Mike Q.
Boeing responding to a former test pilot after he raised concern over the plane maker's now grounded 737 MAX jet. Phil LeBeau joins us now with more. And we said test pilot. One of the pilots that was testing the new, I think of Chuck Yeager when I say test pilot. You know what I mean?
Right. So, well, this was in the simulator still,
Yeah,
on
the simulator, too. Yeah.
Right. And there's still more questions than answers in terms of what exactly did the chief technical pilot back in late 2016, early 2017 mean when he was exchanging instant messages and emails regarding his thoughts on MCAS, talking with regulators, etc. And that's really what this all swirls about around. They started coming out late Thursday night into Friday morning. We saw the sell-off on Friday because of this. And again, it surrounds the MCAS flight control software, the performance of it within the simulator and his conversations or alleged conversations with regulators. Did he mislead the regulators? Now, Boeing on Friday put out an initial statement saying, you know, we are committed to the safety of the 737 MAX. Yesterday, they came out with another statement saying, we understand entirely the scrutiny this matter is receiving and are committed to working with investigative authorities and the U.S. Congress as they continue their investigations. Keep in mind, the board meeting today, met yesterday, meeting today in San Antonio, and the company will be reporting earnings on Wednesday. Guys?
Phil, thank you very much. Let's bring in Eric Dezenhall. He's the CEO of Dezenhall Resources. Also, Mark Dombroff, who is aviation attorney and a partner at Fox Rothschild. Why don't we start with you, Mark, and just talk a little bit about what we see so far. The stock market is not waiting to see what happens with this. Boeing shares were down 9% last week. They're down more than 1% again this morning. What would you be telling people right now?
Well, I think it's premature to really put too much weight in terms of the text messages that we're looking at. I think clearly a lot of questions have to be asked. Context has to be arrived at. I think we have to know what the follow-through was with respect to Boeing and the test pilots involved. It was in the simulator. It was back in 2016. I think Phil's comment about there's a lot more questions than perhaps there are answers is accurate. And I think for anybody to take any sort of action at this stage or make conclusions at this point really is premature.
I should point out again, you're speaking as a lawyer, not as an analyst who's going to be telling people what to do with the stock.
Absolutely.
But with the law, you have time on your side. You can kind of wait and follow things through. If you're somebody who's watching what this means to the company, it's $1 billion a month for every month that they don't get that plane back up and running. And I would say, based on the FAA chief's reaction to this, which seemed pretty harsh, pretty stern, kind of questioning why other agencies had access to those texts and messages months ago and they are just getting this, I would say that that does not bode well for that plane being approved by the FAA or any of the international authorities that would have to sign off anytime soon.
Well, I think that's correct. There's different constituencies or stakeholders out there. Certainly the financial markets are one of them. But looking at it from a safety perspective, this all has to be run to the end game in terms of understanding the context of these text messages, just like the whole issue regarding the investigation. So,
Eric, Dennis Muilenburg goes before Congress and now has this as the backdrop. Not exactly what they were hoping for. They split the chairman and CEO roles, took the chairmanship away from him, and maybe were hoping that that would quell some of the anger from Congress. Now you have this kind of kicking everything back up. What would you advise as somebody who is looking at public relations in this front?
I think you have two issues here. You have the real solution, and then you have the theater of crisis management. The real solution has to do with what the real problem is, which is either an engineering problem or the perception of an engineering problem. Until the airlines are comfortable that these problems are caused by X specific thing, and this is the solution, nothing changes. Then you have the theater of crisis management, which is like an episode of Succession, where everybody is sitting around figuring who goes on TV and does the interview and who goes before Congress, because whoever goes, whoever is public ends up losing their job. And that's what's being debated right now. With the revelations over the weekend, what you have is a lot of red meat for the media and for investigators that they're going to have to answer. But ultimately, the solution is going to have to involve diagnosing what the actual problem is here.
Wait a second. Did you just say whoever goes before Congress loses their job? Are you suggesting Muhlenberg loses his job if he goes before Congress with this?
What I'm suggesting is whoever becomes the public face of this, of something like this, often loses their job, because in the theater of crisis management that we're dealing with, people think that that is the answer, whether or not it really is, because this is the time that we're living in when people don't understand that most of these crises are not resolved through a PR ploy. They are resolved by solving whatever the engineering, mechanical, operational problem is.
Another Boeing perspective on today's podcast comes from Ralph Nader, consumer advocate and author of Collision Course, The Truth About Airline Safety. This is not Nader's first conversation with us about the Boeing 737 MAX crashes. He joined Squawk Box back in May, 2 months after the planes were grounded. After broadcast that day, I asked Becky Quick why we welcome Ralph Nader's comments on the show.
You know, he's a really important voice to be listening on this. He's got over five decades of experience where he's been a consumer advocate. Remember, he's the one who first advocated for seatbelts in cars. And at the time, that seemed like a far-out idea. But really, it's revolutionary. And who can imagine getting in a car and not putting your seatbelt on today?
Nader comes to his advocacy towards Boeing from a personal standpoint as well, right?
He was speaking to us not only as a consumer advocate, but also as a grieving uncle. His great niece was on the last flight that went down. And it's really easy to look at a lot of these situations and gloss it over to say that it's a safe industry. It's a safe industry, but not if you've lost someone you've loved. And he's definitely coming to it both from the perspective of a consumer advocate, but also as someone who wants answers.
Nader is still searching for those answers. Here are the highlights from his telephone interview on Squawk Box today.
Joining us now on the phone is Ralph Nader, and it's good to have you. Mr. Nader, you've been fairly outspoken on this and on previous appearances on the show. I have a feeling that you would point to some of the latest anecdotal developments and say there was a reason for you to be expressing some of your very vociferous points earlier with us. I guess you're not looking at Boeing in a better light now than you were before.
Well, I think because of the internal emails that have now been belatedly released by top Boeing pilots, test pilots, saying that the simulator that tested that software, the so-called MCAS that was put in the planes by Boeing to deal with the increased risk of stalling by the Boeing 737 MAX, that's creating a lot of trouble inside Boeing. It is sparking further the Justice Department criminal probe, and it's angered Congressman Peter DeFazio, who's the chair of the House Transportation Committee, and who will hear Dennis Muhlenberg, the defrocked chairman of the board, who is still CEO of Boeing, who will testify October 30th before that committee. So there are a lot of shoes yet to fall. The analysts should point to that. Congress has not been a factor up until now, but it will become a factor. Even the Senate committee under Senator Wicker is going to hear on October 29th Dennis Muhlenberg, the CEO of Boeing. And also, the FAA is now on its heels, reeling backward because it didn't demand the production of documents sufficiently from Boeing, and it didn't act in time from Boeing. As a aerospace safety expert, Dr. Alan Deal, told me recently, the Boeing marketeers overruled the Boeing engineers. That's how he summarized it.
Let me ask you, though, in terms of steps forward for Boeing, it sounds to me that there's two issues for you. One is the accountability issue, and I'd love to understand what you think being accountable means at this point for Boeing, what would have to happen. And then separately, to the extent that you don't believe that this plane should be in the sky, is there any way that you could imagine that this plane could be put up back into service in its current construction?
Well, first of all, accountability means replacing Dennis Muhlenberg and the board of directors. They now are so dug in.
All of them.
They're dug in so much that they now have a career conflict of interest with the well-being of Boeing in the future. And that often happens when the guys at the top can't say they were wrong, can't admit things, can't change things fundamentally. They are jeopardizing the future of the Boeing Corporation in terms of civilian aircraft production. That's why in Japan and elsewhere, the executives quit. They quit quickly. They resign. And that's why in our country, when corporations were mismanaged like that, they get a change of leadership. It's not happening at Boeing because the people at the top are all in the same pit together. They don't want to admit that they really, really performed in a very seriously adverse way to the safety of airline passengers.
Well, they actually did strip the chairman job away from Dennis Muhlenberg. It's now Dave Calhoun,
yes,
who's in that position, the former lead director.
That's right. That's the first crack. That's the first crack. And they had to realize that it's not good corporate governance for the CEO of a major corporation to also be chairman of the board. The board has to be more independent. But the board has not changed either. The board, either they didn't care to know over the last 2-3 years when all this trouble was being exposed with the MCAS and then the crashes, or they were told and are in complicity. Either way, I hope the congressional hearings will throw some more light on this.
No, the FAA, you didn't even touch on that, and that's we're finding out that there was a lot of, I mean, they worked closely with Boeing, obviously, and that, you know, in the past seemed like something that you would want, but not if it becomes too incestuous, and some of the same engineers that design the plane are giving advice from the viewpoint of the FAA as well, so I'm sure you're not too pleased with that.
That's right, and the new head of the FAA, Stephen Dixon, he's been there about 2-3 months. I think he's going to have to get his own team. I think to have Mr. Elwell, the acting administrator, and Mr. Al-Bahrimi, the safety chief, there is baggage he does not want, it would seem to me. He will want his own team. So look forward to some personnel changes at the FAA. And it's about time that Congress funds the FAA. It's not entirely the FAA's fault, this cushy relationship. All that was pushed by Congress and the White House under both parties since 2005 to delegate more and more of the safety inspection to Boeing and away from the FAA. Instead of being a regulator, the FAA was a delegator, and under Al-Bahrimi, he was planning to go to the next step to be an abdicator. All that has to change, and it can only change if Congress empowers the FAA and provides it with enough budget to have enough technical staff and specialists to do the job for the American people and for global air safety.
Ralph Nader, thank you. Be talking to you again, I'm sure. Thanks.
That's today's Squawk Pod. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. That will help other listeners find Squawk Pod. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.